This is Owen O'Malley with GearWire.com. They Might Be Giants is a long-standing, eclectic, alt-pop group hailing from Brooklyn, New York. They started out as the duo of John Flansburgh and John Linnell. And over the course of 30 years and 15 albums, they've grown into a full rock band, entered heavy MTV rotation, recorded several children's albums and television theme songs, and won a few Grammys, though not necessarily in that order. The group's most recent full-length album is entitled Join Us, and we had the opportunity to speak with John Flansburgh before its scheduled July 19th, 2011 release. Big town can't keep Johnny down. Man
piled up in a towering mound. None of them once has found. Hello, GearWire. This is John Flansburgh here.
Hi. Thanks for taking the time to talk to us.
Of course. So is this about gear?
This is, yeah, we're a gear-centric website. We've got, our audience is pretty much sort of like, you know, gear nerds and home recording enthusiasts.
Because I am a gear nerd and a home recording enthusiast.
Okay, well, I want to start off top.
I want to ask you a question.
Awesome, go for it.
What do you think of Tape-Op?
I don't spend enough time on Tape-Op. That's what I think of Tape-Op.
You don't read the magazine?
Well, I'm kind of spending most of my time on our website, and so
answer the question yes or no, gear man.
I answered honestly. I don't spend enough time on it, or as much as I'd like to. What I've read, I respect it.
It is highly respectable.
Yeah,
respectable.
What do you think of it?
I'm intrigued by it just as a cultural phenomenon because I feel like it empowers some different thinking than like the sort of the common wisdom, but like rock music itself, it kind of just ends up. Sometimes I feel like it's just putting up like a different kind of orthodoxy,
right?
You know, just saying like, you know, it's not like Neumann mics made music bad, and it's not like four track tape recorders make music good. So it's a big aesthetic question, you know, like the lo-fi question looms really large. Like, are people trying to just make things that sound as good as they can sonically, or are they trying?
Well, do you think that's more about intention, though? You know, like, you know, somebody recording with the means at their disposal, is going to be lo-fi without being intentionally lo-fi?
Right. I guess I feel like, I've been guilty of that my entire life. I was just curious for somebody who ran a gear page, what like the take on Tape-Op would be, because it just seems like it's sort of like a radical point of view.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's weird because it's, so my take on it is that it is part of the sort of retro chic culture, and they're putting on a pedestal gear that used to be sort of considered like we're not talking about like 2-inch 24 track machines, but like, you know, a Fostex 4-track reel to reel recorder,
right.
Something that used to be what was most easily accessible to someone as a home recordist, and then they're sort of championing that as some like lost innocence, whereas most people have access to fairly pristine digital recording.
Right. Well, I mean, the Fostex thing is interesting just because Fostex sucks.
but to some people, it sucks in a good way.
Yeah, but they haven't experienced, the way a Teac sucks. The main thing about, like, working with, like, any of the, a Teac tape recorder from, like, way, back when I was a child, which is actually was like my introduction to music. Let me tell you something about myself.
Okay.
I took my summer job money when I was 10 years old and bought a 4-track tape recorder. When I was 12 years old, I bought a 4-track tape recorder. Before I didn't have a guitar. I didn't have, I didn't have musical instruments. Like, to me, the tape recorder was the instrument.
Right.
And I was just fascinated with recording. My dad had a dictating machine. He brought it home from work. And, you know, I just spent like an hour, you know, saying like, hello, hello, and like listening to it back in the dictating machine. And it just, and then I got like a little 3-inch RCA, kind of like a transistor radio, but it was a reel to open reel tape recorder.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
And then I graduated to this 4-track. This is before cassettes or even.
Oh, so this was not even like a Porta Studio. This was like a 4-track reel to reel.
This is the 3340. I still have it, and it still works, which is, you know, a real tribute to proper maintenance. You know, it introduces you to a couple of things right away, like the power of tape saturation. Mm. Like, you could really saturate the tape in a very musical way that would bring up overtones that you just wouldn't. It just illustrates that idea completely, like what's good about that, like how thrilling that effect is.
Well, now you can get that effect in a plugin.
Yeah. That's true, and we like everybody else do, although the way it actually stacks up is not quite as exciting, mm-hmm. and there's part of me that thinks it's because the actual algorithms are not as dynamic as they should be. I was talking to an engineer about this thing the other day. You know, when you use a real Neve console. Right, it's a completely dynamic series of changes that happen to the sound that you're putting into it.
Like just over the course of the circuit in a channel.
As the volume change, you know, as you feed more volume into it, the actual nature of the coloration changes.
Okay.
And you know, what people think of as like that wonderful Neve sound, you know, the Neve sound is actually a series of sounds that go from you know, what you would think of as like sort of just a warm analog sound to a saturated sound to a fully saturated sound. And those sounds are not, that's not a linear kind of distortion. Like
right.
That's actually, you know, those things, and this is such a technical conversation. I know I'm not an engineer and I'm not, my background is not in electronics, so I feel like I might be described, I can describe it better than I can technically explain it. But I mean, the cumulative effect of like a Neve board is not just something like that's the same from 1 to 10, you know, as you turn up the volume, like
right.
it changes the way the coloration actually sounds changes. And the problem with plugins is that they're just making like one capture, like the way Altiverb works is, you know, basically does a pretty good job of capturing the gist of a reverb,
right.
You know, because a lot of times those reverbs are just electronic, but those sounds aren't as it's just not as dynamic a process, it seems
right.
to me.
The idea of a Neve
plugin sounds really great, but until they actually start doing it where they have like a million different captures, I don't see how it's ever going to come even close to being like a Neve board.
Do you think that it might be a sort of a matter of perception, too? Like, do you think that your experience of listening?
Well, I mean, sound is perception, and it's like saying, you know, do you think you're just seeing with your eyes?
Well, I guess what I mean is your perception colored by knowing that you're hearing something off of an actual board, or knowing that you're listening to a plugin?
Well, I'm not, you know, I have nothing, I love plugins. I have nothing against, you know, technology in general. And, you know, as a home recording enthusiast, I think everybody feels very excited about the state of where things are at and what the future will bring us.
Right.
I've had some practical experience in the world before now. And the shortcoming, you know, there's some things that are just, fantastic. You know, we just did a... And we've always done a lot of, home demo work that we've tried to bring in to final recordings.
Right.
And it can be very frustrating, like having a tool like Melodyne where you can just surgically reach into one note of a demo vocal that's a really inspired performance and then fix it. You know, a lot of times, like, the demo vocal will just be like a one-take affair, and you want to, you know, you want to hold on to that, but then you've got this one stinky note, you know, recorded in some very odd way that's really, you can't even sort of figure out how to set up a mic to conjure up the same kind of tone, you know, because it was like recorded in the middle of the night and like the mic was like resting on your chin and,
right.
you know, all that stuff. It's like, you know, we suffer from demoitis just as much as anybody, and having a tool like Melodyne, you know, that's just an incredibly powerful, fantastic thing. Like, it sounds quite natural, and it also is in tune, you know, so.
Do you worry that you are sort of losing something by being surgically precise with something like a demo recording?
No. I think, you know, obviously a lot of people are very lost in the editing process these days, and they're not really giving themselves much slack. You know, I would invite anybody who has like a Pro Tools rig to download the Queen, the multi-tracks of all these Queen recordings that are kind of floating around, because if you listen to those, you know, unlike, you know, I think it's very hard for people to, you know, hear Beatles recordings and hear the way they're, you know, even those tracks are very magical in the way they're all kind of bounced together, and a lot of them are like four tracks, and there are multiple things going on track. The Queen stuff is interesting to me just from a sort of a forensic engineering point of view, because there's so much looseness, and like no one would think like, oh, it's that loose Queen album, you know?
Yeah, right.
But like, you know, you listen to the finger snaps on Killer Queen, they aren't snapping their fingers to a click. You know, who doesn't use a click?
Yeah, right.
You know, everybody uses a click. You know, Killer Queen sounds as exciting as a recording can be, and tight as a recording can be, and yet they chose to do it in a different way than is the common wisdom now. Like, they had the confidence that what, you know, that they knew how to do what they were doing. And, you know, obviously they took time, but, you know, you listen to those guitar tracks, there's howling, you know, RF, you know, whatever the, you know, just like
like radio interference.
There's crazy frequencies coming through the guitar cable just because he's got the thing so jacked up. And there's only so much, you know, editing around that they could do, you know. But it's, I mean, the tracks are essentially, you know, they're very clean, but they're also very, you know, they're as clean as extreme tracks can be. And I think that's an interesting balance. Like, people tend to sort of think monolithically, but what you really need to do is you need to just figure out how to keep it surprising, you know?
So how do you draw that line? You know, where do you say, like, okay, this is, if we do any more editing, you know, you're going to sort of kill whatever magic is in this take? You know, how do you keep it from becoming antiseptic?
Well, you know, I mean, it's a very personal aesthetic. I think sometimes sometimes we're just simply impatient, you know, like we don't want to bother just spending the amount of time to make it, you know, to reach some more abstract idea of perfection. I don't feel like, you know, like what we do is not so groove-based that a lot of times the answers aren't just obvious. You know, it's like most of the editing we do are just like obvious improvements. You know, it's like, oh, you know,
I see. Yeah.
The cymbal is, you know, a little bit behind the bass on that one hit. Let's just pull it in. It's not like we're, you know, we're not putting like beat detective across like entire track.
Right. Just sort of identifying what would otherwise be a detriment.
Yeah, just like, you know, we're just like cleaning up clams, but what's nice is that the tools allow you to save things that are far more eccentric than would have been acceptable. And I mean, the demo vocal is probably like the best example.
1, 2, 3, 4. Mind your business. Mind your business. Mind your never shut Quonset Hut business. Minecraft is exploding.
Over the years, we've worked with, you know, a bunch of producers, like, you know, you know, probably like a half dozen, you know, what in the old days would be called like, you know, hit record maker producer guys. And those have been really interesting. I mean, all the engineers and producers we've worked with have been incredibly instructive for us to just figure out, like, smart ways to get through. You know, the one thing that they all had in common is they had unlimited patience for just getting vocals done.
Yeah.
Like, they would just spend, you know, if you work with, you know, Paul Fox, you know, or Alan Winstanley and Clive Langer or the Dust Brothers, like, you know, you could record a vocal for a whole day. Like, they'll just, like, record a vocal and comp a vocal. And, like, at the end of the day, it'd be like, I don't know, maybe we should just do it again. And, like, you know, there's part of me that, I mean, honestly, I would rather, like, fucking kill myself than spend a second day on a vocal for a song. And there's part of me that thinks, like, maybe that's the difference between, like, people who are really successful at that kind of stuff and me, you know, because they have
fastidiousness.
They're just absolutely tenacious about it. Mm. And they just know that, like, a lot of the magic of a recording is wrapped up in that vocal performance. And, but, you know, for us, it's like, I think we like moving forward, and we like being efficient, relatively efficient,
right,
about stuff. So, you know,
could you talk about who is Patrick Dillett, and talk about sort of your relationship with him?
Patrick Dillett has about Patrick Dillett is great, and if anybody wants to work with somebody who's great, they should work with Pat Dillett. He actually just opened up his own studio in Manhattan, and he has like five different names on that music database because they always spelled his name wrong on records. But he started at Skyline, which was Nile Rodgers Studios back in the sort of the Like a Virgin moment.
Right.
And so Nile had this big, you know, this big kind of ski lodgy studio in the Whig district of New York City. And it was like the go-go 80s and 90s when, you know, Eric Clapton was making huge records and, you know, Stevie Ray Vaughan was making huge records you know, Nile was just totally on the scene. You know, he was the guy. And there was a huge bunch of engineers that got their start there. Like, and it was much more like a classic sort of internship, you know, T-boy apprenticeship kind of way of learning how to do stuff. You know, you would actually, like...
It's like the Abbey Road model. Like,
yeah, like, you know, you'd be the guy, you'd be running the tape recorder, and it would be like, please, no eye contact with the artist. you're doing punch-ins for a guitar player, and they're like just supposed to get the vibe off you, but not look at you.
Yeah, right.
You know, so it's a very, you know, it was quite a place to experience. You know, we made our first record basically on stolen time at this place called Public Access Studio that a friend of ours had keys to, and we would come in at midnight and record. And when we actually put the record out, we were nervous about even crediting the studio because we hadn't really paid for any time. and then on the second album, we made it Al Houghton's studio called Dubway. And he actually he runs a studio in New York City to this day. And evidently, I've noticed on drum corps, so there's a bunch of things on drum corps that were recorded at Dubway. So I'm very happy to see that I'm still working with Al, even though it's just off of sounds and drum corps.
Just indirectly.
But then when we did Flood, we got a major label deal and suddenly had like a, you know, a budget that was 10 times bigger and 10 times more people telling us what we should do. And just, you know, everything was super duper important. Mm. And we hooked up with these producers, Clive Langer and Alan Winstanley, who did the Madness records. And they did a wide variety of big hit songs. They did Come On Eileen.
Right.
They were kind of, what's interesting about those guys is that they were really at the very beginning of what would really be recognized as like the unplugged sound. They would incorporate acoustic instruments in a really heavy way.
Hmm.
Like, almost with kind of a novel approach. Like, they used acoustic instruments as like their stunt coloration.
Hmm.
And it was more about events than it was. If you listen to like those Madness records, they're all about events. Like they don't, they won't have a horn section going through the whole thing.
It'll right. be
like you know, like here's the a horn break, maybe, and there's no other horns.
It's almost like special guesting on a song, like each of the.
Yeah. I mean, like you know, like there's sort of like a rhythm track, and then there's like these events that just happen to kind of catch your ear. It's very pop. Like Clive was a very pop. Oriented guy, like everything was about keeping the listener intrigued,
right?
And like you can really hear that in the what, like the way he put together Istanbul. Like I put a 2-minute demo together on a Casio FZ1 of Istanbul, not Constantinople. Like you could, if you hit the play button, everything you hear on that recording, save for the violin. And save for the violin and the trumpet, everything was coming off very, very short samples made on a Casio FC1.
Oh, wow.
Like the bottle, there's like a bottle blow thing, the melodica part, the acoustic guitar strums are just all single strums that were sampled and then triggered. Everything's triggered. The entire thing is triggered. But when you hear how he sort of, you know, he was brought in and, to sort of help us figure out how to expand our songs, because all our songs were 2 minutes long, and they really needed to be like 3 minutes long to ever
have
a chance to radio. And the way he did it was very nice, because, you know, he cooked up. I had like this vamp at the beginning that was just, you know, probably 4 bars, and he came up with the idea of having this great violin solo flying over it, and that was really ingenious. You know, it was like very, very exciting, and then. The same way with and the way the little break works, just reiterating the melody, you know, so that all really was from his, you know, came from him. And
was there ever any sort of friction there, like sort of wanted to, like preserve the integrity of a 2-minute song and not make it a radio hit?
Well, you know, when the material is as unlikely as the material that we were working with, I don't think anybody felt like. I don't think we felt like we had a lock on the charts, put it that way. I think, you know, we were psyched to be working with people that had such good ears, and they were very supportive. Like they're total gents.
Yeah.
And you know, and we liked the music that they had done before. You know, and that was really important to us. You know, that they had a. I mean. And just getting back to the gear part of it, like the technical grasp that they had over engineering, just in and of itself was worth the price of admission. Like we had this amazing, we were layering kick drums, which was like layering sounds was something that was very popular in the early days of like MIDI / digital recording.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember we were laying some like punchy kick drum along with like a less punchy kick drum, and this is all going from MIDI, you know, sampled MIDI gear to be printed on a 24 track tape. And Alan and Clive were like listening to this thing going down, and Alan was like, those kick drums aren't together, you know, that they're just not together. And like, you know, we look up from the Mac computer 5-inch screen and go like, well, they're both on, you know, MIDI note 1000. You know, it's like, well, move it a couple of ticks back or whatever. And Clive and Alan were listening to this stuff, and Clive was like, you can't tell me that isn't together. And Alan was like, I know that's not together. And I'll show you it's not together. And then he slows down. He takes the 24 track. You know, throws the tape on the other side of the capstan or whatever, and just starts rocking it back and forth. And you saw, you know, the machine's going, wah! And sure enough, like the kick drum one comes in a whole lot faster. And it was just the envelope of the sound. Like it's the kind of thing that with a visual that like you get with Pro Tools, everybody knows what the answer to that kind of story was.
Yeah, right.
But we were just dealing with like the oral part of it. And to have somebody, you know, like Alan, who could really hear that just from experience, you know, just from working with sound for 20 years, you know, and he could just, he just knew it wasn't tight. That was very impressive. And like, we, there were so many things that you learn from working with a guy like that. Like,
yeah.
I feel like the social component of making recordings is something that's really like, it's unfortunate that so much of that information is lost when everybody's working in their own, like, you know, working on their own, like in
right.
their own studio, home studio situation. Like, as exciting as it is to just be with your own stuff and find your own way, I feel like I learned all these things 10 years into my recording career that I wish I knew when we started.
You know, and also it sounds like the production work, you know, after sort of getting major label backing, but before John Henry, sounds pretty painstaking.
Well, it wasn't painful. I mean, it was, you know, it was fun. You know, it was like completely fun. It was like a total, I mean, we've always been ambitious about it.
Right.
We just never really had the tools. You know, at in the beginning, we had no budget at all. But, you know, it's like it was a strange combination of, like, hi-fi and lo-fi. Like, our aesthetic is, as I was saying, like, I guess we're interested in extremes, you know.
Okay, yeah.
And, you know, one thing that happens sort of automatically when you're working with samples and electronic-based music is that there's this kind of alien clinical thing that just is introduced without even trying.
Right.
You know, when we were working as a duo, you know, we were basically arranging things like they were Beatles songs. You know, there was a drum part and a bass part and a guitar part and a keyboard part, but because it was a drum machine, a synth bass, an accordion, and a guitar, it just came across automatically really different. But we actually stuck to, just speaking of arrangement ideas, we really stuck to trying to do things that way for a lot of our early career because we didn't want it to be too much of a... We didn't want the tape to overwhelm what we were doing on stage.
Right.
So we kind of kept like the sound effect part of the backing tape to a minimum. You know, there'd be some like specialty moments where it would really take over, but we didn't want it to... This was in a pre-Milli Vanilli world, but I think we were aware that it might seem vaguely puppet show if we, you know, if we let the track do too much of the heavy lifting. We basically approached our live show like it was a combo, like we were a four-piece combo, even though there were only two of us on stage. So virtually the way everything was arranged, it was like a four-man. Four-piece band.
So now that you've been recording sort of as a full band since, I guess, for like the past 15 years.
Yeah, and we finally figured out how to do it. I feel like, you know, honestly, like, you know, the second we took on the, you know, sideman working with a band, mm-hmm. like, two things happened. I'm sure John has a different take on this, so I don't want to speak for him, but you know, basically, our live show got unbelievable, like celebratory, like mind-bending, barnstorming, rowdy, dancing, sweaty, screaming, like just everything you want in like a live show. And then, our recordings, it became very difficult to know what direction our recording should go in because a lot of that live energy just translated as something a lot more stock on record. You know, like there's part of me that I have to say, like, I don't know how much the world cares about quality drum sounds.
Right, right.
You know, in some, there's part of me that actually thinks the world hates quality drum sounds.
And especially, like, you know, drum recordings and that production, that part of the production process strikes me as something that is super codified. You know, there are certain things that you... There's certain steps that you take when you're recording. Like, you know, you do bed tracks, and then you do... It just seems like the live band recording process is a much more set in stone, possibly.
Yeah, and also, to be perfectly honest, in a couple of ways, I think what we figured out in the fullness of time, and it really took, like, a long time, mm-hmm. is that... If you go to the left of the mainstream way of working or go to the right of the mainstream way of working, you're far better off. Like, you're better off just doing your home demo with all the fucked up impulses that you have to arrange your song, and then bringing in players and just amplifying whatever that is.
I never knew love could be like this. I never knew love could be like this. I go around thinking I'm a genius, but I never knew.
You know, we'll do a demo and feel confident. You know, we're confident enough about where it's at that we'll just add a drum track to that.
Mm.
You know, like replace, like, you know, sample drums or program drums, whatever rhythm section kind of idea there is. We might just replace that, and that'll be it. You know, that'll be the whole process. Or we'll do, and we kind of learned the efficiencies and the awesomeness of this way of working by doing incidental music for television. We'll have everybody in on the session. Like, we'll record the piano track at the same time as the drums, as the guitars, as the bass. Like, actually have, you know, 3, 4, 5 guys playing all live, and make all the arrangement decisions like it's, you know, like it's a Atlantic Records session, you know, like, just be like, hey, let's, you know what, on the second verse, you lay out there and make room for his fill, and, you know, just like really arrange it. You know, you have the energy of doing something. You know, a lot of times the guys are playing the song for the first time, so it's like very new to them, you know, it's all new to them.
Right.
And so they're just kind of, you know, wrapping their arms around the whole thing. So you get a lot of fresh ideas. I mean, we also have the advantage of working with guys who are totally awesome.
Yeah.
You know, it's a great process because it's much unlike the thing. The process that really stinks is where the studio process ended up, which is recording the drums first and then recording the bass,
right?
Then recording the guitars, and then recording the vocals. Like, everything about that, like, the idea that you wouldn't know that you want to bring the song down a whole step for the singer till you were, like, a week into tracking it, is just so depressing and so lame. And yet, it's, like, something that happens all the time. Like, you know, you just hear people's nightmare sessions where it's like, oh, we had to do all this, and it's like, oh.
Well, it seems to me. So you said that you guys kind of like, you like to work quickly, you like to record quickly, but that would seem to be at odds with the sort of a reticence to, you know, buy into that methodology, that sort of standardized methodology.
Well, there's nothing faster than working with a full band.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, you can walk into a session and, like, 2 hours later, just, you know, have two complete songs tracked.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's when we were doing incidental music for Malcolm in the Middle and a bunch of these other TV shows, like, we would record 25 minutes, 30 minutes of music in a day.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
You know, and it was like totally, I mean, some of it was really shitty music, but, but, like, just the actual, just the girth of it was like, you know, it was incidental music, you know, and these are all cues, you know.
Is there stuff that was on Join Us that was tracked that way?
Oh, yeah. There's lots of stuff that was all plays, as we say.
All plays.
But, you know, Join Us was much more, I would say the previous two albums, the Else and the, this is kind of like an evolution of the Elf and the Spine.
Yeah.
Because it's really the same set of people in the room, and kind of working a lot of the same ways. I think this was much more about bridging the sample-based stuff and the program stuff with the band. This was a little bit more fragmented and just in its approach. You know what? You know what's a kind of a useful way of working if you're into sort of blending electronic and natural sounds? Our drummer, Marty Beller and I were working on this Jonathan Coulton project at the same time as the They Might Be Giants album. So we were spending many, many days together and just sort of like strategizing about how to approach drums.
Right.
And, you know, we did a lot of, we came to a lot of simple conclusions, like if you're working on a song where you really want to push the vocal or an acoustic instrument over the top of the mix, if you don't have cymbals on a song, like don't, you know, even like try leaving out the hi-hat, that is a great boon to a song. But we also did this thing where we have this Roland like octopad kind of thing. Like it's not the octopad, but it's the Roland six pad thing that you can load sounds into.
Oh, so the sampling one that you put your own samples in it. Yeah.
Yeah, we have this sort of sampling one, yeah. And we would just have that be, you know, right next to Marty's snare, and we have all these custom sounds in it. And as we're working on, you know, arranging drum parts, we could incorporate those sounds direct, you know, instead of having to like replace a drum sound with a sampled sound or trigger something, just having the ability to do the arrangement with electronic sounds completely integrated into the drum kit was a really, you know, I mean, it won't take you to like Radiohead levels of left fieldness, but it's a nice bridge. It's a nice way to bridge an organic drum sound with a more progressive drum sound.
Right.
And it's in an organic way. Like it works for him as well. Like he can, you can audition things very rapidly, and that's super useful. And I think it's part, that trick is actually, you know, which comes up a couple of times on the record, is really pretty useful.
So are you writing songs as a band, or, you know, has the songwriting process, at least for you, changed a lot since like working in a full band context?
No, you know, John and I write separately for the most part, and mm-hmm. and then collaborate on some things, and then when we put the productions together, we kind of, you know, when needed, sort of come in as like, you know, arranger, collaborator, sounding board, you know, warning signal, you know, and just like, you know, just like the productions are really big collaborations. You know, everybody is involved in sort of, and that's why it's like important to have like a really good team. I would say, like, you know, John and I are, you know, kind of, you know, I would say we'd be described as first among equals. You know, like we, uh-huh. you know, we have like a certain kind of veto power over a lot of things. But if, you know, if the guys in the band have a strong idea about how to approach something, you know, we'll let them go at it. You know. The songs are all demoed, you know. It's like there's a lot. The home recording part is a very seamless. You know, we really spent a long time kind of working on these like sort of these demo tracks that you know, sometimes they're the template upon which people are playing, and then other times it's just like a total do-over.
Right.
But the spirit of the demo is something that looms very large in whatever we're doing.
And what do you use to demo? Like, do you have like a home studio setup? Or?
Yeah, both John and I have. You know, we started with Digital Performer back when it was just a MIDI sequencing program.
Right.
And you know, truth be told, there's a ton of programming on all these albums. Mm-hmm. You know, a lot of the keyboard sounds, a lot of the drum sounds are in some part programmed. Mm-hmm. You know, sometimes not, you know, not to any robotic effect, just, you know, that's the way, it's just an efficient way to put it together.
That's just the arrangement process.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, basically, like, they're pretty straightforward, pretty humble home recording setups. Like, we have, Linnell's got, like, a Neumann mic that always sounds really good, mm-hmm. sounds really good on his voice. I've got a Sound Deluxe U60... seven, that's pretty awesome. Mm. I think the big home studio improvements that we've experienced over the past couple of years is like getting Altiverb was a really was really good. Jogor impulse responses are really fantastic. Pat uses Amplitude on a lot of things for just for mix purposes to bring things out.
Right.
We've been using the, I'm not sure the name of the company. Is it Phoenix that does a Dark Essence? You know about Dark Essence?
No, I don't know
that.
It's
a vocal. It's like they're. It's basically a tape saturation simulator. That's the impression I get. But you know, our setups are pretty minimal. We don't have that much like that much outboard gear. I find that like running sounds through amps is a good way to kind of heat things up a little bit. Mm.
Well, let's talk a little bit about, you know, I guess your live rig. You know, you're playing guitar primarily as part of the live show.
Yeah.
So what do you play?
Well, I play a Fender Telecaster, looks like half the people in the world. I play through a kind of esoteric amp called Exits. It's XITS. That is made by this fellow. It's basically just a handmade boutique amp. It's really like a very nice AC30 with a little bit more versatility.
How'd you find out about those amps?
You know, through like Vintage Guitar Magazine and general like guitar geekery.
Yeah, I see.
In the studio, I tend to use much smaller amps. You know, I've got a Gibson GA40, which is like the Les Paul amp.
Oh yeah,
and,
right.
And a Princeton, and I just have those like wired up all the time, and can run anything through them. And they're, you know, they're not really like volume. It's not really about volume. If you push the input, I find that a lot of times for me, pushing the input is a better sound than actually cranking up total like actual amp distortion
and getting loud.
Yeah, you know, I just bought this thing that I wish I'd bought like 10 years ago, which is the super hard-on pedal, the Zvex super hard-on pedal, which is basically like a very, very clean, extreme volume boost.
Right.
And it's perfect for me. I think if only it wasn't called the super hard-on, I would have bought it a long time ago. The name really, really kept me away. The idea of like staring down at the word super hard on for, you know, 100 and shows just seems.
You can always do that punk thing and put like gaff tape over it, you know, so no one knows.
I think I probably will.
Yeah.
Although then it'll like lose all its resale value. I mean, those Zvex pedals are like, they're like super pricey. But it's good circuitry and it does a really good job of driving, you know, like that. I think that kind of sound is a great driving sound that isn't just like over the top.
Right.
It has some focus to it. So, and then the only thing I use, the only real secret weapon I have in my live rig is I have this synth pedal, the Line 6, the purple Line 6 pedal.
Oh, yeah, what is that called? Yeah, well, the filter modeler, I think. It's
yeah, our crew refers to it as the Barney pedal. Because it's so purple. But what's great about it is it does something. It does a couple of subtle things that are actually like, you know, if you have a distorted amp and you use a wah-wah pedal, sort of like the toggled wah sound, like where it's like a.
Oh yeah, I think it's called set cue mode, where it's
yeah,
like, the wah is on but you're not moving it.
Yeah, exactly. So which gives you like a very you know, kind of Queen like.
Yeah, I was just going to say that was like sort of Brian May's like.
Yeah, it's a very sort of Brian May like. It really cuts through in this great way.
Yeah.
That's kind of the subtle version. And then there's all these just totally, you know, mind-bending synth things that you can do that like there are very specific moments in the show where the guitar will just like, you know, take over what's going on. And the guitar synth is just if you get it set up right, I mean, you really have to work with the box. It's like the most guitar specific pedal I think I've ever worked with, because if you have a different guitar going into it, it won't even make anything close.
Oh, I see.
Sound.
Yeah,
it's
right.
Just got to have the exact same amount of volume feeding it to run these effects. But that's a really, you know, that's, I think that purple box is probably the least popular of the Line 6 things, and to me it has this the most points of interest. There's lots of things in it that are, it's got great like octave-y kind of things, ring modulator things. It's very nutty.
I'm really sort of fascinated by this idea of like, you know, the idea of events in music as part of the arranging. It feels like the sort of more extreme stuff that's in that line six pedal.
Yeah.
Would serve that idea, like in a live context too. Like, it seems to make sense to me as like guitar as event, then highlighted by the sort of like wackiness of.
Right. Well, I mean, I guess that's, you know, that's part of our aesthetic is that like, and you know, someone was reminding me of this that there is, you know, getting back to what I was saying before about like the way Clive sort of set up his songs, the idea of having the solos and the intros and the breaks really feel like strong musical events, like really having that almost a graphic impact, is really part of our point of view. I think, you know, just making everything, it's like foreground listening. You know, like, you know, it's the opposite of background listening. You know,
right.
Everything just goes from event to event. There isn't a lot of. You know, I think we recognize the value of breathing room in songs, but we haven't figured out how to do it ourselves.
So, have you done work as a producer for other people's project?
Well, this Jonathan Coulton album that I'm just finishing right now is probably like the biggest production I've been involved in. I mean, They Might Be Giants has taken up most of my time for the past 30 years. I did a record with a group called Mucka Ferguson that was they're a really great band, and unfortunately they decided to break up right as the album was coming out, so I didn't really get the full benefits of that fine project. But I've produced people. I mean, I feel like up until now, I've helped record people, you know, and just much more in like the engineering sense of things, like, you know, like just help them make their way. I worked with a lot of people who had never really worked in a studio before.
Right. So you're like a consultant for them.
Yeah, just kind of helping along as a friend. Mm. And I've done lots of things like that, but with the Coulton thing, it was much more like it was a really full-on collaboration. I have to give Jonathan a lot of credit because he, you know, he's a big home. Everything he's done, you know, including like the stuff he did for Portal, that was all homebrew stuff. Like, he is a home recording enthusiast, and he had never worked in a studio before.
Oh, wow.
He'd never worked with a band before. He's really done. He's just been, you know, he's been self-produced from the, you know, for the last 5 years. And, you know, his work sounds really good. You know, he's a really solid engineer. He's got a really good ear. He's got incredible pitch. You know, he's a great singer. Mm. And, so the fact, you know, he was extremely open to my suggestions. And he would send me demos. We did this thing where, basically, I asked him to just give me a vocal and guitar-only demo. Like, I didn't want to hear any of his drum tracks. I didn't want to hear any programming. I didn't want to hear anything. Because I wanted to really work. Because I didn't want to go into the pre-production cave with him. Because I felt like the one thing about the way the tracks worked in his stuff is that they were always really good. But they were not necessarily great.
Okay.
You know? Yeah. Getting back to just the idea of solid production. There was lots of like solid production sounding stuff, but there wasn't like that. There wasn't that crazy spark going on, and trying to figure out how to get some of that into the tracks seemed like that was like what that was my responsibility. Was like trying to help him get to the next, take it to a different level, just in terms of the sonics.
Right.
And but you know, he was so open. Like I think I've been spoiled forever working with a guy as reasonable and unneurotic as he is. I mean, I couldn't, you know, if anybody made the kind of suggestions that I made to him, to me, I would just be like, back up, buddy. You know, like, you know, he was just very, very open and hardworking. I mean, he would just go at it. Like, if I made a suggestion, he would try to affect that change right away.
Right.
You know, he just really took stuff at face value, and he was just, I don't know. The guy is fantastic. And the record is fantastic.
Is the record out already?
No, it's coming out this fall. It's a really interesting. There's some really interesting collaborations on it too. He did a track with Sarah from Tegan and Sarah.
Oh yeah.
Did a duet with I don't know what you call it, like a sort of like an Everly Brothers thing where he's like he did a collabo with John Roderick from The Long Winters and Suzanne Vega sings a song.
Oh wow! So Jonathan Colton, I was introduced to him. Because he sang, he worked on the audiobook version of John Hodgman's book.
Oh, yeah, sure.
I think that he was sort of introduced, maybe to me and other people, as almost like a, I don't want to say like a joke songwriter or like a comedy songwriter, but almost like kitschy or like quirky, you know?
Well, yeah, I think you know, he did this thing called Sing a Week that, you know, sort of resembles the Dial Song project that
right.
we did.
Right.
And I think just the nature of that was of just like kind of chaining yourself to your desk like that. You end up, you know, you end up doing some very lighthearted stuff. It's like you're not going to do 52 weeks of gloom.
Yeah.
You know, that was part of the challenge of this album project, is like trying to find a way to take his songwriting to another place. You know, he has a lot of musical ideas and a lot of lyrical ideas that are kind of beyond that. I think some of his officially funny songs are just awesome songs. You know, that R.E. Your Brain song is it's a pretty great song. I mean, anybody who's had a job can relate to that song, you know. I mean, it's just like, it's exactly what a hostile work environment feels like.
Do you think They Might Be Giants set up like preconceptions like that, or had to fight against people's preconceptions like that? It's like sort of at the beginning of your career, like people pigeonholing you as sort of novelty act?
Well, there's a problem with comedy and music,
really?
which is that it's a bad idea.
Yeah.
And it breaks the basic rule of good music, which is it is not designed for repeated listening. and you know, when you think about it, that's really like, that's what, you know, how do, you know, what's the measure of success for a recording? Like, you want to listen to it again and again.
Yeah, yeah.
So it's like, you know, it's basically the humor is kind of like that dragon hot sauce. You know, it's just like, it's really exciting at first, but it's just, or the rooster. You know that rooster sauce?
Oh, what is it? Yeah, it comes in the big clear bottles.
Yeah, yeah.
Sriracha.
Like humor in music is like the rooster sauce of, you know, of food. You know, it seems like a great idea, like the first moment you experience it. But if it's not really designed or doesn't have the kind of texture to hold up, you figure that out, like as you do it. You know, like when we were making our very first record, we had this song called "Hideaway Folk Family." It was like the quietest song in our show for the first couple of years that we were playing, like really, really quiet. And we would it was sort of a stunt, like the way it was set up in the show, because we would. Say, like, we would tell the audience, you know, when we give you a signal, we need everybody to scream like they're in hell. And we'd even like practice it with them, and they would scream really loud, like seem super rowdy. And then it's like, okay, now we're going to play the song. And we'd play this impossibly quiet song. And then in the middle of it, signal the audience, and they would all scream, and like we would, you know, hit the stomp. Stompbox pedal, and it'd be super loud. And you know, it was incredibly, just as theater, it was incredibly effective. But it was exactly the kind of thing that, like, you know, you would never, just can't be done on a record. Like, then you're making a comedy record. Like, you know, then you're making a Cheech and Chong record. So it's just like figuring that out as we went along, and figuring out what things just needed to be quarantined into like a linear live experience.
Right.
Now, I remember when we were recording this song, we performed the song Older. We have the song Older that has the refrain, "You're older than you've ever been, and now you're even older." Mm-hmm. And before we had ever made a recording of it, when we would do that song live, you know, people would just like fall out. You know, because it's the just the idea of the song. It's like it's the most, you know, it's just constantly resetting itself in this linear way. And if you've never heard the song before, it's an incredible experience in a live show. And I have to say, like, I felt kind of sad that we, you know, obviously, like, we wanted to make a recording of it. It's like a song that people love.
But it sort of changed what it was.
But yeah, it goes from being like an experience to being a ritual, you know?
Yeah.
Like, it's like, you know, I don't know how exciting it is to see, like, Pete Townsend smash a guitar, but I bet the first time he smashed a guitar was really interesting.
Right.
But you kind of need, you can't have the warning.
Right.
But I don't know, you know, just getting back to the thing, I think it's just about, it's just a question of balance, you know? You got to figure out how to make it not be weird, and it's not for everybody, you know. Like I mean, I think of all the musicians I know. Like almost all the musicians I know are incredibly sharp, funny people.
Yeah.
And none of them have any interest in inserting any sense of humor into their music. Like that is such a recessive trait. Like in general, people that seems toxic. I remember. Like thinking about this years ago and thinking like music is kind of like soap operas. There's like, there's never any humor in soap operas. Like you think like, you know, you're watching General Hospital and the nurse comes up to the other nurse to talk and there's like, they just start talking in dramatic tones. Like that's not the way life is.
It makes soap operas hilarious.
Right. But I mean, you know, people are joking all the time. You know, cops are joking with each other like, right before and right after, like, crazy stuff happens.
Right,
you know?
Yeah.
Like, it's just like, that's part, real life is very, you know, there's a lot of levity in real life.
Right.
But
that's sort of what always, to me, like, that was sort of like what was special about the music that you guys wrote was because it didn't shy away from that.
I think it's kind of an accomplishment. I don't want to, like, pat ourselves on the back too much, but I think finding the balance between those elements was not like a natural, obvious thing to do.
Right.
And I think we sort of did it in a way that makes popular music less adolescent.
Huh.
Like it's like, to, you know, we were in our 20s when we started this band. We were like already older than you're supposed to be. And we already had jobs, you know, like we already were just in, we were in the world. Like we were, you know, I mean, when I see pictures of us, I think we look like tadpoles, but you know, the truth is like, you know, we had adult problems, you know, before, you know, when this thing started and that's it's different than being like, you know, some bar band in a college town, you know, it's just a different deal. Like, I mean, every band comes up in a different way, but I think we were interested in just trying to take like rock past the like permanent, you know, rebel stance.
Yeah, right. Well, there was something definitely appealing to me about that when I was in middle school and I heard you guys the first time.
In middle school, yeah. Excellent.
Yeah, yeah.
Now I'm feeling like Peter Tork.
I would never want to do that to anybody. I'm sorry.
I understand.
Thank you so much for being generous with your time.
Oh, of course. Thank you so much for hanging out.
The 15th studio album by They Might Be Giants, Join Us, will receive its official release on July 19th, 2011. A pre-order with 4 digitally delivered tracks is available now at theymightbegiants.com. And as always, stay tuned to GearWire.com for your daily dose of gear news, reviews, how-tos, and interviews. Thanks for listening.